This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome to Word for Word. Dean Beck with you and Tim Newton here today. Thank you for joining us. And our guest this morning is arguably one of Australia's most prolific painters. And when it comes to Australian landscapes, it would be difficult to find a living artist who has dedicated so much to canvas. Born in Wagga Wagga, he has, for most of his life, been based here in Melbourne. And having exhibited over 70 solo shows from New York to London, his artwork is more sought after and commanding higher prices than ever before. With a career spanning over 50 years, his academic achievements are almost as grand as his artistic talents. And with a new exhibition about to open, and a newfound obsession with, of all things, Chinese landscapes, he doesn't look like he's about to retire anytime soon. Jeff Macken, welcome to Word for Word.
It's a pleasure.
Jeff, fascinating to speak to an artist on radio because, of course, we can't show your art, but we urge people to jump on their Google machine and have a look at some of your work. When did you first get that passion to pick up a paintbrush?
Well, when I was about 6 or 7, my grandmother, her name was Reynolds, gave me Frederick George Reynolds pastels. Frederick George Reynolds, forgotten artist today, but he died penniless in Hyde Park in Sydney doing, the Mona Lisa on the pavement and put his hat down and people tossing a penny or two. So it's right from an early age, there didn't seem to be any choice. I was sort of, the decision was there, and also it's basically all I can do. I was brought up in the country, and drawing is what I've always done from an early age. I think it's true that we draw before we write or walk, almost.
But they asked John Farnham why he sang, and he said, "Well, I can't do anything else."
That's about right.
So sometimes you just know what you can do. Yeah.
But that's not quite true. I mean, you've been an arts academic, so you must have some intelligence there as well as an artistic flair.
What's intelligence got to do with being an art critic?
Depends.
Well, an academic intelligence, I guess.
Depends, what's the definition of intelligence? I work visually, although we're discussing visual matters here today verbally. It's a verbal language system that you employ. I employ a visual language system. There are many definitions for literary and numerical intelligence, not many for visual intelligence. Most people think that if you can copy what you see truthfully, that you have visual intelligence. But that's simply a copying skill. It's almost at the level of a craft.
And if you can write about it eloquently, then that's different again, and often referred to as the academic skill, I guess.
The writing of it, I love writing. It's always been my passion. I'm not very good at it, I don't think. And, writing is, there are a couple of books out there somewhere, and a catalogue raisonné of Olson's graphics and so on. But, and for many years, writing reviews, book reviews, art reviews and so on for one of the local papers. Anyway, the writing is it's visual, it's thinking for me. To me, I don't really see much difference. One of my heroes is Walter Richard Sickert, a fine English painter of the turn of the 19th century. And his day job was writing reviews for a number of papers in the UK. And to me, making art and writing about it is a thought process and then a visual manifestation. It's one and the same almost. But most painters will tell you they'll make a thousand decisions in a day when they're working with a painting, because whether you put pink here or black there, or what colour, what tone, what form you're going to use. If you're working on plein air, which I do, I'm a particular sort of landscape painter. I go out into the field and paint on site, which is as I was saying earlier to Tim, I think, that the Melbourne tradition, or the Melbourne home, the Australian home of the landscape tradition, is Melbourne, the Heidelberg School, Robert Street and Condor, all those chaps. And I think it's the writing, the painting, the decision-making is all one and the same.
Let's backtrack on what you were just saying a little while ago about thinking about numbers or thinking about images and the different types of way we use our brain. Just spoke to somebody recently, and they were speaking about the concept of dyslexia and how a lot of people who in the past were visual thinkers but not particularly good with numbers or analysing systematically, were seen as dyslexic because they weren't able to work in sort of straightforward rational concepts, but were very good when it came to thinking visually. And rather than explaining things to them in analytical ways, you could explain to them by drawing pictures for them, and they were able to understand visually. It clearly, people who are artistic are of that type that just see the world in a different way.
That's true. I think one of the great sources for artists, for over 100 years or more, is what's been called, quite wrongly, I think, disparagingly, outsider art. You may have been to the art fair that just came to town a few weeks ago and seen there's a stall there called Art Projects, I think, which showed a lot of works of art by intellectually handicapped and dyslexic, not students, but teenagers. And the work is fantastic because there's not that big body of knowledge between their need to express themselves somehow and the expression itself. There are many local painters, for example, Mark Schaller, David Larwell, the so-called Raw Group, who have looked at outsider art and modelled a lot of their own responses visually on it. Internationally, of course, there's the Cobra School in Scandinavia of mid-20th century, and, of course, Jean-François Biscay, the American, who graduated firstly from street art or outsider art, the platforms in the subway and so on, to fine art in the gallery.
But aren't these just, again, ways that the rest of the society put art into particular boxes so they can perhaps understand it better?
Most of the people who put art in boxes are non-artists. You know,
Well, all these descriptions of outsider art and Heidelberg School, I mean, they're really just boxes that people can conveniently sort of put different artistic impressions in.
That's true. Most of the art history is written by theoreticians and philosophers. And
do we call those wankers in modern terminology?
Oh, well, there are a lot of artists who are wankers too, but I don't know. But I think I welcome intellectual discourse on what I do, I think artists are in a way they're fair game for everybody, in university circles, scratch of philosophy, you've got an artist. Most of the curators and directors of our leading state and national galleries today aren't artists, there was a time, for example, when they were. So I think, everybody basically to travel as an artist or be known as an artist is a bit, it's become a popular sort of journey to make, but they're not artists. They don't do anything creative. Many people don't write. They don't paint. but they work with ideas. And this has become known as many things like conceptual art or performance, installation. And it's on the cusp. I sometimes think of it as a sort of cuspism, something that's it's really a hybrid intellectual form between what used to be a traditional discipline and no longer is, but has mutated into a much broader gestalt of former, you know, mono disciplines.
Jeff, your creativity from such a young age has certainly evolved, and I said in my introduction that you've found new influences in your own work from Chinese landscapes. And yet you're touted as the heir to the Heidelberg School. One of, you know, Melbourne is associated with it. Can you explain to us how that progression in your life has changed, how your paintings have changed, how your artistic expression continues to change?
The show, this show at my son's gallery, I'm becoming reasonably well known as the father of James Macon.
How do you feel about that?
Fine, I'm very proud of him. He runs a great gallery, as far as I'm concerned. Personally, it's the best gallery in Australia, in Collingwood, where I had my first exhibition with him. It's a newly designed gallery. But look, it's a long journey. The show's called The Journey. I started off at art school. My first lessons were 1959 with an old-time a Hungarian artist called Desiderius Orban in Circular Quay in Sydney. He'd known Picasso and Braque, and what he taught was a type of cubism. Then I went from there, from Orban to down the road in Lower George Street, Circular Quay, Sydney, to the Julian Ashton School. Ashton was an old-time private school, and from there to the National Art School at East Sydney Tech. What we were taught was a type of Cézannism. Cézanne was, you know, every day we'd get Bonnard and Cézanne, mixed in with a type of quasi-Slade School academicism. There was no... Aboriginal art was not taught, never mentioned. You know, there was no Eastern art. It was totally French, with a peppering of German and...
But very European in its...
Totally European. Yeah. And certainly Australian art wasn't mentioned. You know, Robertson Street, and I didn't really hear about it until I came to Melbourne in 1969 at the invitation of the late Fred Williams, who I think was a great landscape painter, and in that direct line going straight back to Streeton. And then having already been to art school for 5 or 6 years, I discovered that I really had to begin to learn again. And when you begin to study the Melbourne landscape tradition, it eventually leads you many years later into Chinese painting. So that more or less answers the beginning and the end of the journey.
I have seen those mountains for myself that are often depicted in the way
they're depicted. You've been to
Hangshan? Yeah.
South of Shanghai, one of the four Buddhist mountains.
Yeah. And
Guilin.
Guilin, yeah, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's amazing how, I don't know, that those artistic pictures are just like what they're like in real life. They're not stylized in any way. They just look like those classic Chinese landscapes that we see.
Hangshan is the one that I believe is the most painted. But the first thing you have to rid yourself of, speaking personally, was, you know, those Frenchmen on your wrist. And then, of course, perspective. The perspective, there's no perspective of the lineal kind that existing in China. Perspective is an Italian invention in many ways. Alberti Italians. And the
but Hiss. They have a depth. Or you're right about the perspective, but they'd have a depth that is very different to anything European.
They do. It's a near and far that usually moves in threes. There'll be three mountains which will show a progression of form, then a sea of mist, another three mountains, and then as you move up, what we call the picture plane. But you end up with a waterfall, which they see as the blood, the veins of the landscape, and of course the rocks are the skeleton. They're the bones of the landscape. So it is very much a living entity.
We're speaking with Jeff Macon, and he is the artist with a new exhibition called The Journey coming up, and we'll be back to speak to him further on Word for Word.
From Melbourne's Joy 94.9, nationally on the Community Radio Network, this is Word for Word.
Our guest in the studio, Australian landscape artist Jeff Makin. Jeff, if you're a pilot, your first solo flight is something you'll never forget. If you're gay, the thing that you'll never forget is when you're coming out. I suspect for an artist, probably the most memorable moment would be the first time you get paid for one of your paintings.
Yeah. Actually, my father was very supportive. He was... his opinion changed dramatically when I sold him I won my first art prize, actually, and he could see that I could make a living. He was a country publican. But as a younger man, he wanted to be a muso, and of course, the war intervened, and he was, you know, had his sensibilities, and his leg shot to pieces in New Guinea, and it never happened. So he didn't really encourage me in one sense, but when I turned 21, he bought me a really good old easel, which was rather good and which I still have in value. And I won an art prize round about that time, which was judged by the then director of the New South Wales Art Gallery, a fellow called Hal Missingham. It was the Rockdale Art Prize, my first art prize ever. I don't know how much it was too long ago. But Dad began to change his attitude, and he could see that when I turned 21, I was running one of his pubs in Pitt Street in Sydney, and as a licensee, and as an only son, honouring my, you know, sort of responsibilities to my father.
Your chosen honor path.
Honour thy father, as it is. And anyway, he was pretty good about it. He could see that, he said, look, you need a different day job, because the pubs keep you up till 2 in the morning, and even in those days of 6 o'clock closing, but it wasn't quite like that. The one at the Cross didn't stop, for example. Right. He ran a hotel, and people, you know, the vice squad, which was led by a fellow called Bumper Farrell, used to drink in the bar, and Dad'd just throw him the keys and lock up when you finished, fellas. And so it was a 7 day a week, almost 24 hour a day gig. And so I started to teach art in firstly primary schools, and then in what were then the technical colleges. And then when I came to Melbourne, I had a show in 69 with Sweeney Reed, the son of John, Bert Tucker's son by Joy Hester, but although some dispute about that in a number of books. John and Sunday Reed out here at Heidi. And from that exhibition, I was offered a teaching job by a fellow called Alan Warren, who ran Paran Tech. And to cut a long story short, I took it. And that basically gave me much more time to paint than running a pub.
So who bought your first painting? And what was
the
painting?
The first money I made from art was the Rockdale Art Prize. The first show I had in Sydney was with Frank Waters. Frank and Waters and Jeffrey Lager are partners who run the most successful and still do gallery in Sydney, still going. And one of the first people I remember clearly to buy a painting was a Sydney collector and his partner. Wasn't Tony Eldham, it was, name will come to me.
That's all right, keep
and,
going.
And anyway, they were small paintings, $80 or $90, something like that. And from that, I was offered a contract. They had contracts in those days from the Macquarie Galleries, which is the biggest gallery in Sydney at the time, no longer exists. And so there was a small amount of money coming in every month, and I just taught and painted.
So did you see that you could actually make money out of being an artist?
You don't become an artist. You don't make your mind up to become an artist. As I said, with one of your first questions, it's very much, you know, it's all you can do. And you enjoy doing it. Money doesn't really come into it, to tell you the truth.
But you have to pay the bills.
Pay the bills, sure. You get by. Melbourne has got a tremendous collector base.
Is teaching something that you enjoy doing, or is it something that you have to do, I guess, to pay the bills to a point?
The teaching, art schools in those days were very different to what they are today. The old Pran Tech, for example, was a place where Sidney Nolan took part-time classes. It was, though, all of the staff were practicing artists.
Because today's adage, administrators. Today's adage is that those that can't do teach. Yes,
that's right. It was the adage back then too. That adage had been around for a long time. But in the what became known as the CAEs, the Colleges of Advanced Education, which became degree granting institutions and subsumed the old TAFE schools. TAFE, yeah. They had a policy, a good policy, of employing a very small full-time staff who were the administrators of the school and a very large part-time staff. So I remember old Roger Kemp, for example, a great artist, lived down at Sandringham, near Sandringham. And Roger would do 2 days' work a week, then go back to his studio. And the young students just loved him because he was having exhibitions and people would go. And students in those days used to ask, well, who are the exhibiting artists on your staff? It's quite different now. When those art schools were subsumed by the universities, suddenly people like Roger Kemp, who didn't have a diploma or even a leaving certificate, weren't eligible to be employed because from a university standpoint, they didn't have a PhD or a master's or a university degree, so they were deemed to be unqualified. And this is the going back some time to the Dawkins review of tertiary education in Australia. So all of those artists, people like Roger and many, many others, were no longer employed by the art schools. In fact, things changed. The tenured staff element became 90% and there were just a few visiting lecturers for the other 8 or 10%. So that meant that there are fewer and fewer. The linkage between the art school and the profession was very tenuous indeed, if not severed completely. But to answer your question, for 2 or 3 days' work, it was during the day, which meant that most of my generation learnt to work in the evenings and at night and on weekends. Plus, the academic year was shorter, and generous holidays, and you could do a residency or paint. So it tended to be much more. It was a tremendous trade-off between institutional life and the profession itself.
Yeah, probably sounds a bit silly to ask this question as an atheist, but is painting or being an artist something that you can teach somebody, or is it a God-given gift?
Yeah, that's. I think that my observation. I've lectured and taught all around the world, at different places, some very great schools. Indeed. And I believe that the gifted student or the student who has some talents or a need, this is important, a need to express themselves visually, learn more rapidly. That, I believe you can teach everybody to draw, for example, to a certain level. What happens with the gifted kid or adult, or, you know, there's no time limit on this. It's not a young person or an old person or middle-aged person's calling. It can be done at any stage in your life. But the gifted person can do it more rapidly, just in seconds, whereas the less gifted person or somebody with no predisposition to art at all, it takes months or maybe years. They will learn eventually.
I suppose the question is it nature or nurture?
It's both of those things. I think that the some of our best artists, Francis Bacon, for example, I went to London only before last just to see his show. I'd met Francis years and years and years ago in London, and always this big retrospective that they had at the Tate was just huge, and I went there and I could see that he was never taught. He also didn't draw just in the way we think about drawing. He was just simply had a need to express himself visually. The worst thing that he could have ever done for himself would have been to go to the Slade or the Royal Academy or take lessons, because he had a very strong visual in his mind, a very strong image-making facility that an academy would have probably taught him out of. And but on the other hand, there are others who, let's take another English artist, it's safer than taking an Australian one, the late Ewan Uglow, who was used to teach at the Slade, a very, really over-educated artist, you know, very intellectually based work. He'd been taught by Coldstream, had been taught by Sickert, but both produced great work. So there's no one church here, you know, and in a way, whether there's a church at all doesn't matter. It's to do with the visual expression, how potent it is, how original. That's a modernist word, not a postmodernist word.
Can it get to be like the musician, though, that is technically brilliant and has absolutely no emotion in their expression whatsoever?
No duende is the Spanish. You know, the Spanish will talk about the duende and the flamenco guitar players. Absolutely. Sometimes the thing about Bacon, for example, is that he painted a scream. How do you paint a scream? Like, how do you visualize or imagine a scream? There's that wonderful painting by Picasso about the bombing of Guernica, and there's a horse's head in that painting which has a sharp conical tongue, and the teeth are ajar. And this is a wonderful invention, putting a cone with inside a horse's head. This horse is screaming. So he's been able to visualize this extraordinary red-hot emotion. Now, art schools really don't teach you that. That comes from the heart and from your ability.
I'm just going to come back and have a talk to you about modern art and art critics and the whole art scene today, because clearly a controversial subject, but something that we'd like to have a talk to you about.
This is Word for Word across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Dean Beck and Tim Newton with you.
Jeff Macon is our guest, Australian landscape artist, and I'd like to explore with you, Jeff, the concept of being an art critic. And well, let's look at modern art as we go through this journey. When I go to a lot of art galleries, I like art, but I know what I like and I know what I don't like. I see a painting and I either get something out of it or I don't. Yet critics are going to tell me that one piece of art is better than another. I found this completely absurd.
That one is highly valued compared to another.
Yeah, I can see a red dot on a bit of black canvas and a critic can say that's one of the most absorbing, wonderful things that have ever been created, and they'd poo-poo a magnificent landscape, which I might prefer. But how can an art critic possibly say that one art is better than another piece?
Good question. I started writing criticism in 1971 or two, and so it's been 40 years, I guess, and that question is something that I've given a lot of thought to. I think the job of there are levels of art criticism. Let's sort of simplify it down to newspaper, magazine, and then and books, collected essays, reviews, and so on. The newspaper critic, I think, is always limited by space, and it really is what, when, and where thing in the first couple of paragraphs. But the job of the critic is, I think, to, in many ways, impart his or her love of art to the reading population, the audience, to get it across that this is something worthwhile going along and viewing and looking at, that is going to enrich your life. That it's the second thing is to classify it, if you like, to say what it is. Is it non-figurative, figurative, abstract, realist, abstract expressionist landscape? If it has, does it have a subject? Is it on canvas, or is it performance? Is it something that's static or dynamic?
But they can do that, but they can't say whether it's good or it's bad, surely.
Well, this is where you end up drinking alone, and paranoia is the critic's disease, and I believe that you can, because I think, not so much as a young critic. Young critics tend to be very combative, and they're trying to,
sell newspapers.
Sell newspapers, but also argue the point and get their own point of view across. But I've always believed that the history of art is, in fact, a history of standard, that if you're working for example, with still life, if you're a subject matter painter, certainly you have to ask yourself, well, how does this still life that I'm making compare with Chardin or Giorgio Morandi or any number of still life painters that have worked back through history? And in the contemporary sense, you also have to ask yourself, well, is still life as a subject an appropriate subject to be expressing at, you know, to be using in the postmodernist era? Does it, in fact, in some way mirror this time and the major arguments and debates and issues of this time? So there are a couple of questions there, but one can say, for example, that this still life painter is better than that. Once you look at a painting, let's say, if you look at a painting by Margaret Olley, you know, she's working with flowers, solid static objects, and as in fact of thousands of others down through in the Australian tradition and also internationally. So one can ask yourself, well, does she paint apples as well as Cézanne? Does she paint bottles as well as Morandi? So there is an area there to debate and to reason. The bigger issue is the one of cultural authenticity. This comes up all the time in relationship to Aboriginal work. The Aboriginality of much dot and stroke painting today is in question, because the people who did them may have only been painting for 12 months or 2 years or 3 years. Emily King Warry, for example, took up painting at age 79, was dead at 86, having left over 6,000 works of art, many of them large canvases, behind her.
She painted 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the entire career of her painting life.
Mm. I mean, you're saying she didn't sleep.
Well, I'm asking that question. Yeah. I mean, how much of those are authentically hers, I guess, is the question.
That is the question. Yeah. What's bringing the Aboriginal market unstuck is this question of authenticity. Mm. And also Aboriginality. Is it, in fact, a genuine expression of Aboriginal dreaming? Those answers are becoming... I think it's affected the Aboriginal market. I think that the price is going down.
If I painted with that style, the dot and stroke painting, would it not be taken seriously because I'm not... ethnically Aboriginal?
The Aboriginal art tends to travel to about 1973. Jeff Barden put them onto canvas with acrylic paints in 73. He was a teacher out there.
It's a very good docker that the ABC...
Oh, lots of dockers now. Yeah. And so you think in terms of pre-Barden, post-Barden. There are fors and against with both eras. But one of the problems with time and again, you'll read in a foreword of an Aboriginal exhibition that, Rover Thomas is just as good as Mark Rothko, that these look like wonderful abstract expressionist paintings. Now, if you're an Aboriginal artist and somebody is giving you your ticket to fame because you resemble Rothko, who wasn't an Aboriginal, who's a Jewish painter, the genealogy of his work has nothing to do with tribal art or Aboriginal art. It's a bit like the second-class ticket. I would have thought that one should be talking about the authenticity and the actual symbolism and traditional meaning of those roundels and the dots and the strokes and also the aerial view and the dream time, the ancient myths and stories that come down from ancient Aboriginal culture. And the more intense that vision is, I would have thought, would determine the quality of the expression and also ultimately the price. I think there's a point where the aesthetic worth of something coincides with the financial worth.
Jeff Macon, the likes of painting sold through large art fairs that are open to the public and paintings that are now adorning hotels by one artist and this type of thing. Plus, we have the internet, which means that an image of a painting can go worldwide and theoretically you can, or your son, through his gallery, can sell your artwork to anywhere in the world.
Now,
once upon a time, sorry?
A facsimile, a copy?
Well, no. The original can be forwarded on.
Oh, okay.
Right? But you now have a market and a gallery, if you like, online for the world to see.
Sure.
But once upon a time, art was sold almost, particularly the high-end stuff, almost by networks and one-on-one type trading to find its way onto gallery walls.
That's right. You've actually, the internet, my son James, for example, his gallery, James Macon Gallery, has a fabulous website. He was in there very early, and of course his generation were teethed on laptops, and it's just second nature to them. As a result, he does a lot of business over the internet, sells to Los Angeles, to London, and people see the image. Usually they'll follow that up with, that's the first gambit, then they'll say, look, I'm interested in this painting that you've got, da-da, can you give me a condition report? And of course, what follows from the condition report is usually a sale, or, well, no thank you, but maybe next time. So the internet has been a great sales device for those sorts of galleries. The other thing that's happened is that your point is correct. If you go back to the 60s and the 70s, the collectors were a small, elitist, tightly knit group of people. Sometimes they knew each other, other times they did not. Rudy Koman, for example, back in the great late 60s dealer in Sydney, used to show Williams, Olsen and the rest. Rudy had... He really looked after about 20 or 30 collectors who all collected his stable of artists. It was a small, tight coterie of dealer and collectors. Today, it is no longer that. It is a people's business. Everybody's an art collector, and I think it's just wonderful. That sort of elitist thing is not there.
Has it devalued by being so open now?
Oddly enough, there are a lot of new collectors out there, your mid-30 IT millionaire type, who sometimes they engage consultants, sometimes they don't, but they walk into an art gallery knowing very little, but they really do, the first thing they'll do is Google you. They'll go back and they'll do the research because that's their tool.
And that's their provenance,
and next time they come back, they say, oh, yeah, in 1974 you did this, yeah, and yeah. I said, did I? Yeah, that's right. And
they've
got
more
you.
About you than you do.
Absolutely. So those people are very, very astute because the old type collector wouldn't do that. He'd take the advice of the dealer, meet the artist, have a few reds and buy a painting.
Right.
Now the new type collector has you placed internationally. They know all your auction records. They know your entire CV, where you've been, and so on. And then they ask themselves, well, do I like the painting or don't I?
Now, James, Jeff, your son James, at the James Macon Gallery, has got the exhibition. It starts on it started on the 12th of August, goes through to the 4th of September. Now, you say that this is one of the most important collections of your life. Why is that?
Well, there are lots of reasons. It's a father-son thing to start with. This is my first major show with James. This is his new gallery. It's only been this gallery. I gave him a hand to build it early last year. It's a big space. He travelled the world several times looking at galleries in Milan, New York, and all over the place getting ideas. There are some ideas there that he's employed that are unique to his space. So as a father, the moment he announced that he wanted to become an art dealer, all of my other dealers, I said, well, I'm sorry, fellas, it's over. James is now going to take on the work. There wasn't any choice. But this is the first large show. It's a big show. There's 36, 40 works. And, you know, there's the father and son thing. You have to do the best you can by your son. And the
That's
second
a good
thing,
kickstart for his new business, though.
He's selling extremely well, for example. He's had several sell-out shows. Wonderful artists are supporting him because he was burped on Fred Williams and Sid Nolan's knee, and along with mine and others, John Olsen, for example. He's got the trust of the artists, and, you know, he just had a Godwin Bradbeer near sell-out. He's wonderful. Some people say the greatest draftsman in Australia. I don't know whether you know of Brad Beer's work. He's done extremely well with two younger artists just recently near sellouts, Jenny Rogerson and Wayne Viney. And then there are a host of others. Ian Parry, a Tasmanian artist who he has under contract. Ian sells very well. You mentioned the art fair, for example. James did extremely well at the art fair a few weeks ago.
Well, your exhibition is called The Journey. Mm. Thank you for sharing your journey with us this morning on Word for Word. We appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure.
This has been Dean Beck with you and
Tim Newton.
Till next week, take care and we'll talk to you then. Bye.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Briley and presented by Dean Beck, Sue Wilkinson and Tim Newton.
Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.